This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Trump and your finances. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Happy New Year. Yeah, sort of, if you're back to work, right? Monday, January 2. Thanks for being with us, and here's what we have for you this hour.
As Donald Trump prepares to take office in 2.5 weeks, so look at what Americans think about what his time in office will mean for their wallets and bank accounts.
Unsettling story from the medical field, the dangers of differing standards from state to state for screening newborns.
On the health front, there's a new trend emerging at the gym, and it's being led by women. We'll explain it in about 20 minutes.
And strange facts you may not have known about billionaires.
This company, GoCompare, looked at the Forbes billionaire list, and they tried to just analyze certain things about it. The first thing they did was analyze the birthdays of these billionaires, and the most common astrological sign was 12.5% for Aquarius. That's compared to only 5.9% of billionaires are Cancer, and 6.1% are Libra.
I'm Aquarius, still waiting for the payoff. Katie Hill at MarketWatch has a look at billionaire facts later in the hour. Let's start with politics here. How did Rex Tillerson, CEO of ExxonMobil, suddenly emerge among the more popular names to become Donald Trump's selection as Secretary of State? Philip Rucker at the Washington Post says the unexpected decision provided an object lesson in the decision-making process and leadership style of a president-elect who has never worked in government and is applying his unorthodox style to decisions that could shape the world. Phil, explain.
Well, this has been the most sort of public and an up and down process for Trump of selecting a Secretary of State. It's gone on for more than a month now. And a few weeks ago, he was looking at Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney as the two leading candidates, but he was not thrilled with either of those choices and was sort of casting about for some sort of alternative. And in walks Robert Gates, the former defense secretary to both President Obama and President George W. Bush. And Gates said, "What about Rex Tillerson?" And Trump didn't know a lot about Tillerson, but began to research him. You know, he's a renowned chairman and CEO of ExxonMobil, one of the biggest business leaders in the world. And Trump invited Tillerson in for a meeting at Trump Tower, and they immediately connected. They saw themselves both as sort of global deal-maker, negotiator types, and Trump really liked the stature and gravitas that Tillerson seemed to project.
Interesting. So behind the scenes, as you say, the process reflected Trump's refusal to be rushed or pushed and showed how he was not necessarily beholden to his strongest supporters.
That's exactly right. He was getting a lot of pressure from the outside not to choose Mitt Romney. He was also getting a lot of pressure from some of his advisors and donors to select Rudy Giuliani, but he harbored his own doubts about Giuliani, and he kept hearing whispers about Giuliani maybe being past his prime or too old or not sort of showing the stamina mentally and physically to do a job like Secretary of State, which is so demanding and all-consuming. And so Trump wanted to go his own way. He went with Rex Tillerson. He's not a household name. Tillerson is not somebody that a lot of Trump voters out in the country have an immediate reaction to, but clearly has an impressive resume. There is one problem, however, that's going to be the subject of these confirmation hearings, and that's his relationship with Russia, and specifically with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Yeah. I think to a certain extent, too, this is why Mr. Trump attracted a lot of attention during the campaign, and that he seems beholden to no one.
That's exactly right, and it's what his supporters see as refreshing and, frankly, a needed change in Washington. And, you know, he's mixing it up with Tillerson. We've not, at least in the last few decades here, had somebody with that kind of background as the Secretary of State. It usually goes to someone who's a politician schooled on foreign affairs like John Kerry or an academic like Condoleezza Rice. And so forth. And this is a new model to have a businessman, somebody who's operated globally, but on behalf of a corporation and shareholders instead of on behalf of the American people. And so we're going to see how Tillerson works.
We're speaking with Philip Rucker, national political correspondent at The Washington Post. His piece is called "Trump Wasn't Happy with His State Department Finalists, Then He Heard a New Name." Obviously referencing Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil. You point out, too, he did not seem worried about the potential for a difficult confirmation. Should he be?
He is not worried. I think he should be concerned that it could at least be a messy confirmation, if not more seriously troubled. There are a few Republican senators, including Marco Rubio from Florida, who happens to sit on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who have voiced some pretty serious concerns about Tillerson because of the Russia connection. And so we're going to see if that, you know, actually means they would vote against him or not. But the confirmation hearings very well could turn into a proxy battle over this Russia question, and that is not going to be that helpful to Tillerson, I don't think.
So what happens to somebody like Rudy Giuliani now, a guy who's been a staunch supporter from the beginning? Does he get rewarded somehow with some other position?
Yeah, it's a great question. Giuliani has announced that he is not going to join the administration. He really wanted Secretary of State. It was the one job he said he wanted, and he campaigned publicly for it. So it's a little humiliating for him to not be chosen. But that's not to say Trump didn't want Giuliani in the administration. He wanted to consider Giuliani for Homeland Security Secretary, for Attorney General, perhaps for other positions. But Giuliani only wanted Secretary of State. Mm. He did not get it. And now he's going to stay out of the administration and hopefully, as far as he's concerned, try to maintain his friendship and close alliance with Donald Trump and talk to the president frequently.
Thanks, Phil. Philip Rucker at The Washington Post. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News.
This portion of the show is brought to you by Dell. Help employees increase productivity and do their best work when you upgrade to new Dell PCs with Intel Core processors. Learn more at Dell.com/radio.
Transition seamlessly from presentation to meeting and from work to home with the Dell Latitude 13 7000 series, the laptop that takes care of business. The powerful performance and incredible battery life from this reliable business-class PC featuring Intel Core processors lets small business employees do their best work wherever work takes them. Learn more at Dell.com/radio. That's Dell.com/radio. Here's another frustrating and maddening look at the field of medicine, specifically the screening of newborn babies, and how when state labs ignore the science and common sense, the results can be dangerous. Reporter Ellen Gabler at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has found that differing standards from state to state, plus questionable medical lab practices, have allowed babies to needlessly get sick and suffer debilitating strokes and other life-altering medical emergencies. Ellen, what have you dug up here?
So basically, every state is allowed to set their own policies and procedures for doing this testing. And a lot of those policies and procedures are set based on funding. And the other problem is they're not always up to date in terms of science.
As part of that, though, take me through this story of this little boy that you wrote about, Mel Russell.
So there's a little boy in Wisconsin named Mel Russell, and shortly after he was born, he had his newborn screening sample taken, as babies do, and his result came back as possibly abnormal. And so he had a second sample taken, and it came back as normal. And the thing that his parents didn't know, the thing that his doctors didn't know, was that he was just on the borderline of being called abnormal. So if he had received an abnormal test, he would have been referred immediately to a specialist and where he would have been diagnosed. Unfortunately, what happened is he wasn't diagnosed, and at 18 months, he suffered a stroke and brain damage as a result. And so, you know, he has some significant disabilities because of that. He actually has a little sister with the exact same disorder. She was diagnosed at 2 weeks. And she's a typically developing 5-year-old.
No
so
kidding.
The stakes are really high.
Boy, and this was like the numbers that came back on this one test, right? It was like a fraction of a fraction below triggering some sort of alarm, right?
Yes, that's right. So the cutoff value in Wisconsin that would have led Mel to being sent to a specialist was 0.20, and his result was 0.1998380. That's less than 0.2 of a point.
Wow.
And so those 0.2 of a point is kind of what made the difference. And what was interesting was the state labs, they're trying to balance this issue of false positives. So a false positive is when the results come back, they tell the doctor, hey, something might be wrong with this baby, and then it turns out that the kid's fine. So they want to minimize those false positives because they don't want to create this kind of cry wolf scenario.
Yeah, yeah.
But the problem is when they try when they minimize these false positives too much, they end up missing kids. And that's what happened with Mel. That's what happened with two of the other kids in the story. And it's, you know, happened many, many times in throughout the country.
Well, we're speaking with Ellen Gabler, investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and her piece is called The Price of Being Wrong, talking about newborn screening. So what's being done here? Have you gotten a sense that things have changed at all, say, since your story?
There's a couple challenges. So number one is you can't sue a state lab. It's very hard to sue a state lab. State labs, state entities has something called sovereign immunity, and that comes from the English common law of the king can do no wrong. And so the idea is you don't want to be, you can't sue the state because then they can't provide services for the rest of the community. But what happens then is in some cases they're not held accountable, and so changes aren't made. And there's some examples in my story of that where the state lab should have made changes, and they didn't, and as a result, kids suffered brain damage. So that's one of the challenges is, you know, you can't sue these state labs. The other thing is newborn screening is run on a state-by-state basis. So there's a federal advisory committee that reports to the U.S. Secretary of Health, and they, you know, they've made recommendations to make newborn screening more uniform. However, states can just do what they want.
Thanks, Ellen. It's investigative reporter Ellen Gabler at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Here's a secret circulating in gyms across the country. Women want to lift weights and heavier ones. Many women have used 5 or 10 pound weights as part of workouts, but in recent years, more women are lifting heavier weights, spurred in part by intensive regimens like CrossFit. Watch for this in the new year, maybe even today, as those New Year's resolutions are still fresh at the gym. Here's this morning's Jennifer Koshenka.
Yes, women do want to lift weights. Gyms all across the country are expanding their weightlifting areas and classes to accommodate an influx of women. Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal has more on this lifting trend. Rachel, what's attracting women to weightlifting?
Well, I think there's more research all the time about the benefits of weightlifting, that it can help stem the muscle loss that happens as we all age, and help boost our metabolisms a little bit, and all kinds of other beneficial effects that that women are seeing. And the other thing is, I think there's been a long-held misconception that if you lift weights, especially heavy weights, you'll get very big and bulky like a bodybuilder, and that's really not true. So that's also something that's really the message that's spreading among women in particular.
And it's especially true that women of a certain age need to lift weights too, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we do lose muscle as we age, and strengthening exercises of all kinds are one way to help prevent that. And so doctors would definitely recommend some kind of strength training for women as well as men.
How much has the popularity of CrossFit impacted the way women are lifting?
I think it's had a big effect. You know, CrossFit's been around, I think, for about 15 years now. And it's a fairly intensive exercise. I mean, it's definitely not for everybody, but it definitely pushed into the mainstream these Olympic-style weightlifting approaches, where you're lifting heavier weights from the ground. And although not everybody has done CrossFit, I think a lot of people have been exposed to it. And mainstream gyms have copied certain elements of it or mimicked it or sort of drafted off of its popularity. And I think that in part is what is inspiring some of these classes and even boutique studios to add classes that have heavier weights or that focus primarily on heavier weightlifting.
Rachel, describe what's happening in weightlifting areas in gyms and also classes that are being changed or added in gyms.
Well, two things are happening. One, I think the gyms have not really realized until now, they're just starting to realize how much demand there is from women to lift heavier weights. But because of the rising popularity of lifting free weights in general, weight areas are getting crowded. And so they're finally realizing, oh, we've really got to expand these. And in some cases, they're even creating women-only weightlifting areas, which, you know, that's appeals to some people and not others. But another thing that's happening is group fitness areas, you know, fitness classes inside gyms, which are traditionally very female. You know, places like Equinox gyms are starting to add heavier weights into those classes. Before, they might only have a class where you might use a 5-pound or 10-pound weight, and now they have classes that use weights of, you know, 25, 30, 40 pounds in each hand. So people are lifting serious weights, and they're doing fewer repetitions. So it's really a very different workout than the traditional group fitness classes that we've seen at gyms in the past.
We're speaking with Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal about women who are lifting more at the gym. You mentioned the female-only weightlifting areas or some classes that might be geared toward females. Are women becoming less intimidated about lifting in front of men?
Yeah, I think that's happening as well. The women-only classes are often kind of an introduction for women. And some women I spoke with said that they have tried them there first, and then they expand to you know, maybe lifting weights on their own in a weight area. Or in the case of a woman in a studio in D.C., she started in the women's-only weightlifting class and then branched out into another class that was women and men. So in some cases, I think it's a combination of gaining confidence and also just learning the skills that are needed to properly lift and handle those kinds of heavy weights that kind of embolden women to go out and lift weights other places as well.
How does weightlifting complement other types of exercise, cardio and other things?
Well, I think it can be really beneficial. I talked to one woman who said that weightlifting has actually helped her yoga practice because, you know, there are some yoga positions, you know, arm stands and so on that are really challenging. And so increasing your arm or leg strength can really, really help with those.
That is this morning's Jennifer Koshinka with Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. It's 30 minutes now after the hour. On This Morning, America's First News.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. Like us on Facebook or send us an email. This Morning at CompassMediaNetworks.com.
Thanks for spending time with us on this Monday, January 2nd. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshinka. Belated Happy New Year to you. Coming up this half hour, the top searches of 2016 as we take a look at the last year in review. Also, some strange facts about billionaires and the evicting of an 89-year-old woman. But the story does have a happy ending. We'll have it in about 20 minutes. So how do you think you'll do financially with the new administration? 2.5 weeks until Inauguration Day. Americans apparently are at odds, though, about how their personal finances will fare under President-elect Trump. That's according to a new study by Bankrate.com. More from Chief Financial Analyst Greg McBride at Bankrate. Greg, give us some findings.
Well, just like the election itself, which was, you know, very divisive, when it comes to the impact that people expected to have on their personal finances, there's really no clear consensus either. Nearly 40% of Americans think it's not going to have an impact one way or the other. And those that have a more positive outlook barely outnumber those that think it's going to have a negative impact. 28% of Americans said they think it's going to have a positive effect on their finances. 26% said negative. And what was interesting, Gordon, was the fact that when we looked at both those that felt positive and those that felt negative, their number one reason for feeling that way was tax policy. Those that had a positive outlook, they felt it was because their taxes were going to go down. Those that had a negative outlook, they believe their taxes will go up. So, that one thing is makes clear that people do look at taxes as something that is impactful on their personal financial situation.
Now, it's interesting because I was going to ask you, did they list kind of their wants or expectations here to sort of formulate those decisions?
Well, taxes, that one, whether you're going to pay more or less, that was top of the list. But the other things that ranked in there, whether your income, you expect your income to go up or go down, the value of your investments, you expect that's going to go up or go down, and your household expenses. Do you foresee increases or decreases on that front? And we even saw, fair percentage that said all of the above. You know, really kind of thinking it's going to be a compilation of each of those factors.
Interesting. So the ones who said they had a kind of a negative personal perception of what's going to happen under a Trump administration with their finances also listed taxes. They expect taxes to go up.
Yeah, they expected they were going to pay higher taxes, followed by higher expenses and decreasing income. A distant fourth was decreasing value of their investments, and then about 9% actually said it was going to be all of those factors.
We're speaking with Greg McBride, chief financial analyst at Bankrate.com. They've got a survey out that says Americans are divided over the Trump effect on their finances. What about by age, Greg?
Yeah, some interesting revelations there. I mean, baby boomers, and in particular younger boomers, those between the ages of 52 and 61, they were most likely to foresee a positive impact on their finances. They cited rising income and reduced taxes, as the primary factors for that. And at the other end of the spectrum, millennials, they had the highest propensity of anybody to say it wasn't going to make much difference to their financial situation one way or the other.
Interesting. So what is it about boomers? You get the, were they big supporters of Mr. Trump?
I don't know if it's anything specific about the age group or not. It's, this is a group that, during the sluggish economic recovery, they've been plagued by prolonged levels of lengthy unemployment and stagnant wages. So you may have a belief there that both of those may change for the better as it impacts them at the personal level.
Yeah. Were the outcomes when it comes to politics predictable here?
Yeah, it sure was. You could kind of see this one coming. People's feelings break down very strongly along political lines. So those Americans that self-identify themselves as Republicans or Republican-leaning overwhelmingly expect positive effects on their personal finances. Those that identify as Democrats or Democratic-leaning predominantly expect a negative outlook on their personal finances.
Well, it's certainly gone well, at least so far, when it comes to investments since Election Day, right?
Yeah, we actually, when we look at overall levels of financial security, we see that kind of resonating there. Americans are still, indicative of improved financial situations year over year. When we look at things compared to a month ago, the one that really kind of bubbles up is we see a notable improvement in net worth, and that owing, of course, to the big run we've seen in the stock market since Election Day.
Thanks, Greg. Greg McBride, chief financial analyst at Bankrate.com. 20 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Morning, America's First News. Glad you're with us in a belated Happy New Year. Which newsmakers and trends captured the world's imagination in 2016? Google's annual Year in Search provides a look at the people, places, and topics that sent the world searching for answers this past year. The Year in Search lists are Google's annual look at the trillions of searches performed throughout the year. We're joined now by Susan Kudrecha, Google search trends expert. Susan, what do you have for us?
So this year, we really took a look at what was hot in 2016. And the way that we categorize that is are looking at trending queries, which are searches that had the highest spike in traffic over a sustained period in 2016 as compared to 2015. And looking at the top of the list across the U.S., the number one search term is actually Powerball. So you may remember last January, we saw an unprecedented Powerball jackpot rising to more than $1.6 billion. And that really kicked things off, but throughout the entire year of 2016, we've seen an increase in searches for Powerball. So I don't know if that means that people think that their luck is changing out there, but there's definitely a renewed interest in the lottery, and that's our number one search trend. Number two is actually Prince. Who you may remember passed away this past April. And anytime a celebrity of that magnitude passes away, there's always a great amount of search interest and also a really renewed interest as well in his music. And we saw a great increase in that.
All right, let me ask you this then. So go in the weeds a little bit here. I know Powerball, you said, was the most searched term. Does that necessarily mean it was the most searched subject?
Oh, not necessarily. No, I will say across the board, the U.S. elections, even from a global standpoint, really sort of took the cake when it came to topics across various categories.
Yeah.
For instance, Donald Trump was the most searched person. But you could see that, also in the 8, 9, and 10 categories across the U.S., Donald Trump was number 8 of the top trending terms. Number 9 was the election generally, where we saw a lot of queries coming either from how to vote, how to register to vote, vote, understanding the difference between the Electoral College and the popular vote. And then, of course, coming in at number 10 is Hillary Clinton.
Very good. We're speaking with Susan Kudrecha, Google search trends expert. And we're talking about the top searches for 2016. What about on the sports front?
So looking at the sports front across the U.S., actually the most searched sports team is actually the Chicago Cubs. So that's probably not a surprise. Yeah. I know that they had a big year, and so all the baseball fans out there in Chicago are probably very happy to see that. Also looking specifically at other teams, we saw that the Cleveland Indians came in at number 2, not a surprise there. And then sort of looking over to men's soccer as well was definitely a big search. We saw the Seattle Sounders were definitely number 1 there. And actually looking specifically at some players for baseball, we saw Chris Bryant come in at number 1, Anthony Rizzo number 2, 3 David Ross. So we saw like an interesting rounding out here, but definitely baseball kind of took the cake this year.
Very good. How about on the fashion front?
So on the fashion front, we saw that number 1 is actually Rachel Roy for fashion designers. And number 2, surprisingly, for me personally, it was Mary Kate and Ashley Olsen. You know, they are incredibly popular across a great variety of genres, but number 2 for fashion designers for top trending terms. And then actually, interestingly, number 5, Kendall and Kylie, you know, from the Kardashian clan. You can see that they're actually, you know, beyond just searching from a celebrity standpoint, for fashion designing in particular, they came in at number 5.
Thanks, Susan. Susan Kudrecha, Google Trends search expert. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Transition seamlessly from presentation to meeting and from work to home with the Dell Latitude 13 7000 series, the laptop that takes care of business. The powerful performance and incredible battery life from this reliable business-class PC featuring Intel Core processors lets small business employees do their best work wherever work takes them. Learn more at Dell.com/radio. That's Dell.com/radio.
So in 2016, the world's billionaires clocked in an aggregate net worth of $6.48 trillion. Dollars, with the usual suspects topping the list, right? Bill Gates at $75 billion. Berkshire Hathaway's Warren Buffett, about $61 billion. But if you look deeper into the numbers, MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill says you'll find some surprises. She's got some things you probably didn't know about billionaires. Katie, what have you found?
Well, these are just oddball facts that I found fascinating. I thought, who knew? The first one coming, this company GoCompare looked at the Forbes billionaire list, and they tried to just analyze certain things about it. The first thing they did was analyze the birthdays of these billionaires, and the most common astrological sign was 12.5% for Aquarius. That's compared to only 5.9% of billionaires are Cancer and 6.1% are Libra. So you can see there's this big jump. Who knows why? It's kind of they couldn't speculate as to why so many billionaires were the Aquarius side. But I thought, what a weird thing. You would think it would just be pretty evenly distributed, but that's not the case.
Yeah, because I mean, what do? I'm an Aquarian. We're the water bearers. What is that? How does that lead
right.
you to be a
I'm
billionaire?
Like, how does that make you billions? But hey, you're closer than me because I'm way at the bottom over there.
All right, so interesting enough. So what else?
There is a billionaire named God, which you might not have heard of him, but that is his name. He is a property developer in Russia worth about $3.5 billion. But I thought, God is a billionaire. How funny. But that's his name. Most people probably in the U.S. haven't really heard of him, but he's a big property developer of shopping malls and hotels, mostly in Russia, and he's worth about $3.5 billion.
Oh, the God I'm more familiar with is probably closer to a trillionaire.
Right. He's doing all right. Yeah. That one's doing all right. Yes.
Apparently he's developed things other than property, but all right, so what else?
The billionaire school dropout saga is a myth. So we keep thinking of, oh, you know, like all these tech startup guys, and they went straight from high school, started coding, started these big companies, never finished college. You know, Microsoft's Bill Gates and Facebook Mark Zuckerberg, we kind of think of that because they make so many headlines. But that's really not true. Only about 14% of billionaires have less than a college degree. Meanwhile, more than half have a bachelor's. More than 1 in 4 have a master's, and 7% a doctorate.
You know, it's funny because even the 7% with a doctorate strikes me as too much education to be a billionaire, right? And you spent so
right,
much
like,
time
well,
in school.
How were you making your money when you were in school for seven years after college?
That's something. We're speaking with Market Watch reporter Katie Hill. She's got an interesting story entitled Strange Facts About Billionaires. All right, what else did you find?
They have a lot of kids. Only about 5% of billionaires have no children. I mean, I guess they're like, I can afford it. I'm going to have a bunch. But 21% have more than five or more children. 25% three children. So they tend to have a lot of children. It was surprising to me that just 5% of them had no kids. Again, I mean, you often think of, you know, these young tech starting companies. They're super young. They're out partying. You know, you see them and you don't think about kids. But really the reality is most of these billionaires have a lot of kids, usually 3, 4, or 5 of them.
Thanks, Katie. It's Market Watch reporter Katie Hill, who's based in New York. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. Here's another feel-good story that we could use more of this coming year. It's from the Today Show. When a Florida woman was evicted from the house she had lived in for decades, neighbors rallied to help, including one who gave her the ultimate gift. She bought back the house. Angie Tima, who's 89, has now moved back into her longtime home in Hudson, Florida, after 3 weeks of staying at a Days Inn hotel. Hudson is on Florida's west coast, about an hour north of Tampa. Ms. Tima was evicted after learning the person she had sold the house to several years earlier had stopped paying the mortgage, and the house went into foreclosure. Once the neighborhood saw her belongings being taken out, Danielle Calder, who lives a few houses away, made the decision to buy back the home from the company that had purchased it at auction. It cost $167,000. Well, now this woman, Danielle Calder, is Ms. Tima's new landlord. Ms. Calder, who bought the house, said she didn't need another home, but she did need Ms. Tima as a neighbor. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.